In the past couple days, I've tried to show you some pictures of where the problems are, so to speak, in the inner work. And what I'd like to do now, since we're halfway through, is talk a little bit about solutions. But it's always good to have a kind of a feeling about where the problems are, so when you go to make a solution, your solution is effective. And the whole question of inner work is my inner work effective? Because no one can determine whether or not it's effective except you. And if you don't really have any capacities for telling whether it's effective, basically you're just running around in little circles in your mind. And so this idea of the witness, or this being of the witness, is really the focus of the inner work. It's not just today, it's been the focus of the inner work since the very beginning when mystery schools were developed. Because it was always understood that inside a human being is another human being who is like an embryo. And that human being has a great and tremendous destiny, but is covered over with a lot of beliefs. And unfortunately, we can't depend on Apple or Adobe to get rid of those beliefs. Unfortunately, the only person that can get rid of the beliefs is us. But often we don't know we have them. They're called core beliefs. A core belief. Now, a core belief is the result of a vow we make when we're young about. We have an experience, maybe it's at the dinner table. We see something happen, maybe to a brother or sister, and we say to ourselves, I'm never going to do that. Or we see two adults acting in a particular way, or someone treating us in a particular way, and we say, I'll never do that. And psychologists call it a vow. And then we grow, and we forget that we've made the vow. But a part of us that has made the vow remembers. And there's a problem there. Because the vow may be, we say, I'm never going to do this, but it's just the thing we need to do when we're an adult. We need to take a stand, we need to form an opinion, we need to do something. But we've told ourselves that we can't do that. So maybe we made a vow that we're never going to be angry, for instance, because we were around angry people when we were growing up. And that vow is forgotten, and our gallbladder remembers it. Write that down, Ron, gallbladder. So our gallbladder remembers it, and when the task of the gallbladder is to destroy the fat that is kind of intruding into my system, as soon as it goes to be sort of angry at the fat and destroy it, the gallbladder holds back and says, oh, I can't be angry. And then that builds up and builds up and builds up and becomes an inner attitude that I can't be angry, but I'm really angry. And that causes a great deal of confusion about the inner life and who am I and why can't I be angry, but I'm really angry, but I can't be angry. Becomes actually a pathology. And behind all the pathologies are these pictures resulting from these vows that we make before we can even remember. And they create a kind of block to the real self, who basically has a destiny to change the world. But unfortunately, changing the world involves other people. So there are a couple steps that I've been trying to describe to you, going step by step by step. And one is, just like in the 12-step program, the first step of the 12 steps is, I have a problem. And unless you realize you have a problem, or unless you're in doubt, there's no hope of solution because you don't think you have a problem. So Bill W. Was actually a friend of Carl Jung. Bill W. was an initiate who had capacities to see into the spiritual world. The founder of 12-step program, his name is Bill W. Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill W. is the founder. And his rules, the 12 rules, the first one is, you have to realize that you have a problem. And the second rule is, you're powerless to solve it. Now, it sounds very depressing when you first hear it, but actually, it's the first two steps towards healing. And behind the problem, usually there's a vow about what I told myself I can't do. And the unusual part about this is the things I tell myself as a child I can't do very often have a great deal to do with the things I must do as an adult. They're kind of arranged that way. We could call it the great law of karma. That the very thing you've come back to do is the very thing your parents are creating shadows of at the dinner table. And you tell yourself you're never going to do that, but it's your destiny to actually do that. But in a good way, rather than a shadow way. I've been in this work a long time with people, talking to people about their inner work, and I can tell you many, 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 many times, the very gift that the person is bringing is the thing they vowed they will never do. And so, in a situation like that, we have to find certain ways of overcoming beliefs that we're not good enough, that we're not capable enough, that we don't have the power to change things. We do, but it always involves other people, which very often is a difficulty because they may not believe what we believe. They may not have the core beliefs that we do. They may have just the opposite core beliefs. And if I could just share with you, that's, if you see two people about to get married and you try to think a little bit about their core belief, wow, they are healing forces for each other through the school of hard knocks. So you attract to you people that are expressing things that you have to overcome. Doctors will often say that their own pathology shows up in the office all the time. The people who they try to heal come to them because they understand that this person is dealing with this in their own life at some level. So there's a kind of word, a phrase to describe this. It's that your problem is your gift. Or your difficulty is your medicine. And so rather than pushing the problem away, the task of the person who wants to transform themselves is to own it, to own the problem, to assess the problem, and then begin inwardly working with it as an inner picture. So that's what I've tried to describe to you in the past couple days. Is something that's known in the alchemical language as cooking and eating the shadow. So the vow you make to yourself that you forget becomes something that you project on other people when they don't behave properly according to your opinion. That's called the shadow in the esoteric language. You project that shadow onto the other person with the belief that they're not acting properly when it's really the thing you're afraid to deal with in your own life because you've made a vow that you can't go there. So if we want to get it, this we could call this the Hall of Mirrors. Yeah, it's this kind of who is owning this and who's got the problem and why is life not cool the way I thought it would be. And so everybody goes through it. And everybody gets a big dose of it going through adolescence. And then when they get to be 21, the great cosmos says, here's the keys to the car, and now you have to pay the insurance and pay the rent. And then you're out on the street with this funky car that has all these strange things going on in it, and you don't know why it's happening and whatever, and you still owe $800 on it. And you wish you could just get rid of it. Yeah? So that's, we could call that maturation. And at a certain point in a person's life, the maturation gets so intense that they say, I have to change this. Something has to change. This can't go on. It's not working for me. And when that happens, that's called putting a foot on the path, taking a first step on the path to self-transformation. And it always happens when we feel the worst about ourselves, and when we know we're not capable of something and the challenges are too great. That's just when a door opens in the cosmos and a very still, small voice says, you're bigger than this problem. But because of the beliefs, we can't believe it. So we go on thinking that we have no power. And then we give power to leaders. But the great Saint Bob Dylan said, don't follow leaders and watch your parking meters. And so the leader that we're looking for is us. The authority we're looking for is us. Because you go and find some authority, and they got their own core beliefs that are going on in them. And if you hang around with them long enough, you'll find that out. And you'll say, well, that's not kind of the way I would do it. Now, Rudolf Steiner talks about this. And he wrote a book about it. It's called The Philosophy of Freedom. It's about the task of an individual person to awaken in themselves to the higher being who always has lived in you and will always live in you forever and ever. And the purpose of that being is to learn forever and ever. It never stops learning. It never stops growing. It never stops developing, even in painful situations. And so people who get in contact with that being learn that there are certain rules of the road. And the first rule of the road is that I need to control the images that live inside me. I need to, if I can't control them perfectly, I at least need to address them. I at least need to ask them tough questions. Like, why do you always come and hang out with me? How come you don't go hang out with somebody else? And I need to ask the images that arise in me, why do you always come here for a handout? Because basically, that's what's happening. There are beings on the other side who feed on your fear and doubt. And you simply become lunch. And if you're okay with that, well, then that's the natural world. The big fish eat the little fish, and the bigger fish eat the big fish. And then we eat the bigger fish and get mercury. Yeah, that's the rule. Eat or be eaten. But there's a higher rule, and that is I can address and eat my own shadow before somebody else does. And to do that, I have to get a hold of the inner picture. So yesterday I described one very simple technique for doing that. And the goal of that technique is not so that you get an answer, but that you make your mind much more flexible than you ever dreamed it could be. In the regular world, they call it thinking outside the box. And unfortunately, cyberspace can't think outside the box because everything's in the box. Everything's been designed to be in the box, and if it's out of the box, it doesn't compute. But the human doesn't live in the box. They make boxes that they think they live in, But the real human is limitless understanding. Limitless ability to absorb things that don't make sense. That's the real human. The human that says, I need to live in the box because I'm afraid of getting out of it, well, then they have to play by the rules of the box. But the human that gets in touch with this being that lives inside of them that says, you could be better than you think you are, that being is invisible to us unless we can see in our own inner consciousness how images move. Because that being creates images, but is not the image. This is like a track made by an animal. I know some of you are taking tracking. The track is not the animal. But if you're skillful, you can take the track and tell exactly, was the animal running? Was it carrying something in its mouth? Was it running from something or to something? When did it pass this way? All of it is totally invisible to most people unless you train yourself to take that image and to rework the image inwardly. So yesterday we had a triangle that if you didn't rotate it, you couldn't live into what Goethe called the becoming of the image. And it's very important inwardly to transform my inner life so that instead of having static pictures of beliefs that I can't remember, that I have inner pictures that move in sequences and I can say to myself, these sequences are correct. I need to be able to form inner pictures of sequences A, B, C and get from the inner pictures a very clear perception, these sequences of pictures that I'm holding in my mind are correct. This happens, then this happens, then this happens. If I do that, I stabilize the inner picture-forming capacity in my inner life, and I can use it as a kind of filter for the images that are coming to me from the world. I build a kind of repertoire of images that I have worked to in myself to say, this is moving in such a way that I feel it's correct. So yesterday we rotated a triangle, and you saw that if you looked at the triangle from the side, well, then it became a line. There are many such things like that. The flower comes out of a leaf, according to Goethe. I have to be able to see the transition from the leaf to the flower in my mind's eye very clearly. And Goethe would say, when you do that, you are participating in the becoming of the flower. And the becoming is a kind of spiritual biography of the being using the images of the flower to express itself. The plant you see is not the plant. It's the corpse of a plant. So go down to the Bay Area and go across the Golden Gate. And if you look down, get in the middle of the bridge and look down in the water, you'll see these funny little like streaks in the water, little funny little streams, look like they were made by a slug. And if you stay there long enough and watch, you'll see that those are the wakes of the tankers that are docking in Oakland. You watch a tanker go under the bridge and go out and go down, or Richmond. It's going down to Richmond. It leaves a wake, and the wake stays in the water in the Golden Gate for hours. You wouldn't think that's possible. Try it sometime. I often wondered what they were until one day I saw a ship go through, and then I watched and the wake just stayed there. Your body is a wake of you moving through time. Rudolf Steiner calls your body a flesh vortex. It's an image of your being. And once we begin to see becomings, once we can be flexible inwardly with imagery and make it move, and I practice forming and dissolving and forming and dissolving and forming and dissolving, I build in my soul a kind of inoculant against doubt. It's not saying that you will never have doubt. Of course you will have doubt. But it's one thing to have doubt and then freak out for 2 weeks or 2 months. And it's another thing to have doubt and freak out for a couple hours and then come back. And the difference is, if I work on myself, I freak out and I freak out for a couple hours and then I come back. If I don't work on myself, I freak out, and I can freak out for years and not come back into who I am, not remember that I'm could be a lot more than I think I am. So what I've tried to describe to you thus far in the language of Rudolf Steiner is called active imagination. He got the impulse from Goethe, from the natural scientific work of Goethe, and then worked with other exercises and visualizations to, especially out of alchemy, images out of alchemy, Joachim and Boaz, these mystery school pictures of the snake biting its tail, they're all to develop imagination. All the faculties, all the forms of the Goetheanum and all of that, that's all to develop active imagination. Eurythmy, active imagination. Biodynamics and the preparations, active imagination. In order to see how a cow horn and cow poop are related to each other in a particular way, you have to have a very active imagination. And it has to be very precise at the same time. So we normally think imagination is something that's just fantasy. And in originally, if I don't work on it, that's all it is, it's fantasy. But if I work on it, it becomes a tool for exploring self-transformation. But it's just the beginning. Because always, always, no matter how many tools I develop in myself, I have to take those tools and what I've learned, and I have to encounter some other person. And very often, the other person has a very different set of tools, a very different set of core beliefs, a whole different biography, and a whole different socioeconomic realm that they come from and whatever, and I have to somehow make a relationship to them, because the real goal of this work is not so that I become cool myself, but that I actually develop in myself the ability to awaken within you. That's the goal. But I can't awaken in you if my inner life is just a big bag full of nasty things having a war. I try to drag that into you, and you go, thank you, but I got enough of that myself. So if I work to clean out the bag of shadows a little bit, then I can go to the next level. And the next level, Rudolf Steiner calls inspiration. And the greatest source of inspiration is the person you're sitting next to. Unfortunately, they have their own ideas about things. And fortunately, they have their own ideas about things. So they have made vows to themselves, and they have inner pictures. And hopefully, if they're working on their inner pictures and you're working on your inner pictures, your king and your queen and their king and their queen can go and have a nice dinner someplace. They can relate. They can connect, because there's not a lot of residual. So the goal, the beginning, is to get a hold of the inner picture. And then, strangely enough, the next step of the way is to get rid of the inner picture. And it's sounds like it doesn't make a lot of sense. And in the regular world, it makes no sense at all. In the reasonable world, where I get a job and a career and whatever, it makes no sense at all. But in the esoteric world, the forming of accurate and living pictures and the dissolving of accurate living pictures is a path filled with paradox that is the only path to higher knowledge. Because an old saying is, higher truth can only be expressed through paradox. And the greatest paradox is the human being. It's some kind of mud that gets up and talks and walks around. That's from Kurt Vonnegut. The mud that gets up and talks. So, the developing of a forming of a picture. We had a little exercise last night. I asked you to do this, make the form, then go like this, and then to imagine the form, if you had clay in your hands, what that would be. In order to do that, you have to form an inner picture of something that you can't see. You can only kind of imagine it. And then I said to you, I want you to find two things about it that you think you could use to describe it to someone who is blind. If you could make it out of clay and then give it to them, and they could touch it with their fingers. I mean, obviously, if they just grabbed it and went like that, they'd know what it was. But can you describe this object to another person? So we're going to play with that a little now, because we're going to go to the next level of giving your image away. And the place you're going to give your image away to is your partner. And you give your image away by describing it. If you have in you a description that you think is accurate of what it is, there's absolutely no jeopardy in that at all. But as soon as you open your mouth, and as soon as you share what you think that image is, then there's the shadows come in. And the shadows come in and say, I'm not quite following your description. So we're at this spot in the work. I've asked you to form a picture of something that is could be tangible. That's getting the facts straight. And now I'm going to ask you to release that to the other person, and they're going to ask you questions about what you think this description is that you've given to them. They're going to ask you questions. The questions are part of the negotiation. What you're trying to do is negotiate whether or not you think they are correctly describing this thing. Now, you actually don't have to say a word. So you give your description, and you just look at their face, and if they look like a deer in the headlights, you know that there's some discussion that has to happen. Or if they kind of do one of these, or if they say, then suddenly what you think it is has to be modified somehow or explained. That's called discussion. And in discussion, you have to negotiate meanings. So here's the facts. I think this thing is this and this. Now we're going to go into discussion and negotiation. So you're going to describe to your partner two things that you think accurately describes this thing that's between your hands. And then what they're going to do is simply listen inwardly. They're not going to answer. They're not going to ask you even questions. They're just going to listen inwardly and say to themselves, what am I feeling when I want to respond to this person's description, how does that feel in me? Is it like a sunny day? Is it like a thunderstorm? Is it like a swamp? Is it like a mountaintop? Is it like a meadow with butterflies and flowers on it? How does it feel in me? Because these pictures that I've just described to you are what Rudolf Steiner calls moods. And the whole essence of this work is to be able to find what mood is living in me as I'm listening to another person. And to go there and ask your witness, what's happening with this now? That's the control. So your partner is going to describe to you two things they think describes this form. Your task is to listen inwardly and see what the mood is when they're giving you a description. Okay? And then just listen after they stop, just listen. And then the other person will go and say, this is my description. And then the other person is listening. No conversation. We'll have conversation with the next one. So there's no conversation with this. There's no rebuttal. There's no, well, you said, or anything like that. There's just, they explain, you listen, and you try to see, how does it feel when I try to get my inner place silent in the face of their description? Okay, any questions about what we're going to do?
So that first description in both directions is just two items.
Two items, right. No, it's just two. We just want to do this to get a feeling, because then right after that we're going to do an exercise like this, but instead of having something that's objective like this little form, the question we're going to be asking is each other is, don't you think it's about time for a woman president? And we're going to pair up guy and girl for partners. Okay? And then we'll see what happens when people start giving their explanation. Can I do the same kind of monitoring inwardly to watch what is happening as I hear other people's ideas?
I'm sorry, is that two things? So I'll say two-dimensional, would that be one thing? If you say two things, if it was two-dimensional, for example, would that be one thing?
Yeah, right. It's two-dimensional. If I say this form I have on my hands is two-dimensional, that's one thing, right? And then you say that to me, and then I go, okay. And I'm trying to monitor the quality of my inner response. This is very similar to rocks, paper, scissors, very similar to washing the mirror. It's very similar, except now this has to do with a belief that somebody else has rather than kind of rock, paper, scissors. And then next one, we're going to make it even stronger because there's going to be a definite kind of opinion.
Did you say that we are asking questions?
No.
We're not going to
ask questions. The question you're asking is, what is living in me when I listen to this person's description? That's the question. You ask it for yourself, not of them. Okay? So, just find your partner, a partner. Give them two things, and then the other person listens. This only take 4 minutes, and then we'll go on. So, there's a subtle alchemy in here of energy. Rudolf Steiner describes in a curious way two people speaking to one another. The person that's speaking is very awake to their meaning. The person that's listening has to agree to fall asleep to the other person's meaning in order to hear it. And that mood of agreeing to fall asleep, we could call it surrender. or in the Native American language, give away. I have to give away my own meaning in order to hear your meaning. However, in my inner life, if I've spent a lot of time putting a lot of information in my inner life and arranging things properly, when I hear your meaning, if it doesn't fit with my meaning, I immediately awaken and counter your meaning with mine. Meaning, I do not wish to fall asleep or surrender to your meaning. I assert my own meaning continually, even while you're giving me your meaning. And this is very wonderful in the world of facts and peer-reviewed journals, but can be very difficult at the breakfast table. Yeah, can be a very difficult thing when it's not over an issue that has a bunch of facts, but has a bunch of feelings. And ultimately, in the six basic exercises, three of them are about feelings. One of them is about thinking, and one is about will, and then one is all of them together. I don't think that's random, because I think the next level of the work of humanity is to understand that feelings have a very strong reality, even though they can't be brought down to an objective level. Because as we start to work with our inner life, the first thing we run into is that our feelings are the things that are linked to the vow we made. And if we wish to get at the vow, we have to go into the realm of the feelings and become adept at working with them in such a way that we can honor the fact that we have some feelings which are not really working well for us. That's the compassion for failing. And in the regular world, it sounds stupid, but in the inner world, it is the only thing that allows us to continue working. Much that's in the regular world, much that's in the inner world, sounds very stupid in the regular world. Much. Because it's exactly inverse on the other side of the threshold. Everything we hold true here is just a big joke over there. It's an old saying, if you want to give God a laugh, tell him your plans. Yeah. So if I have an inner picture that I'm carrying, and you give an inner picture of something you think is an objective truth, I have feelings that come up connected to my belief structure that says, I don't think so. And what happens is I awaken and can't allow you to express what you're expressing because I know better. Which, if it has to do with the world of objective facts, is absolutely great. But if it has to do with you expressing feelings about issues in your life, that's a very big problem. And as we go further in development, humans are going to have to address this, because Rudolf Steiner has a word for this. It's called consciousness soul age. The time of intellectual soul age is the time when rigor and peer review journals came into being and objective facts in the world. But we're now moving deeper into consciousness soul, which has to take into account not only your facts, but your feelings. And unfortunately, your feelings are unique to you, and my feelings are unique to me, so we have to practice negotiation in order to make sense out of them. Which means I have to be aware when I'm able to sleep to your feeling and when I'm not. Can I surrender to what you're feeling? And can I let you know that I heard what you're feeling? That then moves up here into purification, conversation, and giveaway. So what you just did when someone told you a solution they thought they had, and you listened inwardly to the feeling that you had come up, that we could call purification. You don't allow your own feelings simply to arise without monitoring it, but you observe it and then try to identify it. How do I feel when this is happening? Can I bring a picture of that into my soul? Now, the value of this is when things get very weird in your life and somebody's blowing smoke on you, if you have a little bit of capacity to do this, you don't have to engage at the mud wrestling level with the person. That's optional. You have to engage the person, but the best thing to do is to be able to monitor how you're feeling in the situation so you don't have to take the poison for the next 2 months. And I'm sharing with you something that took me a long time to learn through marriage counseling and whatever, that after a while you learn that a person's feelings are their own feelings, even if it's connected to something they think is an absolute truth. But the problem is never the truth. If you work with that, you find you can get to the facts at the bottom of it. The fact is, I have connected to those truths very deep feelings about how the world needs to be. And this leads into strange places. So I'm going to read you a quote. This is a quote from Cindy Sheehan, just to give a picture. This is after about 3 or 4 months after she started her vigil. So I'll just read the quote, because there's something that happened to Cindy Sheehan, to the purity of her motive. Yes, sir. Excuse me?
You might want to say Cindy Sheehan.
Cindy Sheehan's the lady who did, her son was killed in Iraq, Casey, and she went down to Texas and sat in a vigil outside the Summer White House or whatever they call it down there.
Robert.
Yeah, out in Texas, and she sat there saying, I'm going to sit here until the president comes and talks to me and gives me a good reason why my son had to die over this war. That's Cindy Sheehan. And what happened with her was when she sat there for the first couple days, she was the most powerful person in the world. Because her motive was pure, it was coming clearly out of grief. This was not rage at the machine, this was grief at the machine, which is a lot more powerful. And she placed her grief at the machine and sat there, and had the media circus left her alone, she could have turned something very big. But a lot of people started to glom onto her power and dilute it, and within a couple of weeks she was talking about running for Congress and changing the world. It was a dilution of the integrity of the pure grief that her soul was finding at a useless and terrible war. And it was compromised by the media, in my opinion. You may have a different opinion. But my feelings for her were very deep. And then I found this quote. After everything had blown up and, you know, hundreds of people were there and they were bulldozing the crosses that were in the road and all this kind of stuff happened, she pulled back and she went and tried to recoup her forces again. And she went to a workshop by Thich Nhat Hanh. This is her quote. Thich Nhat Hanh reminded us to be in the present and to take every step in peace and know that we are walking on the earth in peace. He lovingly admonished the hundreds of people who came to hear his witness to do everything in peace, eat, walk, talk, breathe, sleep, work, play, etc. No yelling, no angry words, no harsh statements. This admonishment struck me to the bone, because I have been so, quote, strident in my criticism of the Bushies in their quest for power, greed, and destruction. There must be a better way now if we truly want our country to live in eternal peace and not eternal war. So what she found was the witness who said, you are creating the polarity by your polarity. She found that through his work. And that allowed her to find a much bigger person in herself, a much bigger force in herself of the power of her conviction. Now, that came as a kind of a shock to her. But the path that I'm trying to describe to you of consciously doing this is a way that you can actually practice in your own life to have the capacity to do that without having to get caught up in the yelling and screaming and blaming. Okay? I just received another wonderful quote this morning. Thank you for this one. This is on www.graduationpledge.org. Sounds funny, but until you hear what it is. This is a graduation pledge given by, so far, 100,000 students. And pledges, I pledge to explore and take into account the social and environmental consequences of any job that I consider. And I will try to improve these aspects of any organization for which I work. Now, I can tell you, when I was coming through and looking for a job, there would definitely not be that on a website, if there was a website, but there wasn't. But that would not be an issue for anybody in my generation except a few rare people. And now, this is making its way into the world. Yeah? Is the consideration of the implications of me accepting a job. That's consciousness soul. And that means I may have to surrender my employment, which is way big. This is bread and butter. But that means that there's something in the consciousness of people that could possibly be the transformative force. Something could change out of this, but it means I have to listen to you. I have to listen to how this impacts you. And that begins by listening to how I feel in me when you express what you express. In order to really hear you, I have to be able to silence what's going on in me. I have to be willing to do that and capable. So, for 5 minutes, you're going to talk, and then I was told we should open up to about 10 or 15 minutes of questions that the people who are running the discussion groups felt it would be better if there were some questions, we could ask questions because it's happening. But for 5 minutes, let's play this little game. The question is, or the statement is, I think it's about time for a woman president. Okay. Or let's say, is it time? Let's put it that way. Is it time for a woman president? And I want a lady to find a guy. And I want you to say, is it time for a woman president? And then have a little conversation. Just a moment. And the exercise is exactly the same. While the other person is speaking, You're listening to what feelings are coming in you, and can you damp them down to hear what they're saying? That's the thing. We'll take 6 minutes. Very good. So if you found that in the beginning it was, oh yeah, da, 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 and then suddenly, like that, then that's the moment when this faculty, if you train yourself to observe these things, this faculty kicks in. And you say to yourself, oh, I'm having one of those feeling events. And then you can bring into that place a little reservoir of acceptance of the fact that maybe there's something that you don't understand in this, especially around the feeling life, and that allows you to be a little more calm in the face of the situation. You may have to take the hit. You may have to go underground for a couple hours, but you don't have to go underground for months or weeks. So tomorrow, we're going to up the ante a little bit with questions. The big question will be, two facts about global warming are. Yeah, and then you'll share with your partner. But the goal is not answers and information. That's down here. The goal is, can I find a place in myself where I can allow their opinion to come into me without having to negate it with my feelings? Can I do that? Is that possible? If I can do that, the next step will be to reflect back to them what you heard. And tomorrow that's where we'll go. Because I'm going to start taking a turn now towards what we could call being a spiritual warrior. And that's, we have to take these things and grab onto them and practice them so when we get into weird situations, we have a little capacity to develop. So, questions?
Dennis, could you read the graduation pledge again?
This is from a group called Real Money, Co-op America's Real Money. It's a little magazine. And the group is www.graduationpledge.org. And the pledge is, I pledge to explore and take into account the social and environmental consequences of any job I consider, and will try to improve these aspects of any organization for which I work. Try to bring an awareness of those, of the social and environmental consequences of my work.
One of the things that came to mind.
Remember, if we follow Kenneth's lead here, remember is, this is my member, and I'm re-willing the image. Rudolf Steiner gives a kind of interesting picture about where the mental picture comes from. He says we construct the mental image out of feelings that are similar to the original experience. So I have in me this kind of sea of feelings. In the ancient world, this is called the Brazen Sea. If you know that, the temple legend, and that is, this is the Brazen Sea. I have this flowing sea of feelings, and then every once in a while, I have to exert my will to remember those feelings into a gestalt, into a construct that gives me the feeling as if I am where that original situation was. So memory is not a passive thing. In me, it involves a certain amount of will. However, in order for me to change a memory, I have to reinvest a different kind of will. So what happens is if I keep remembering that I'm not a good person, or I'm a failure, or the world is bad, if my will keeps giving me feelings that that is true, then I have to exert a different kind of will to overcome that in my inner life. In other words, I have to find the picture that is creating the feelings that keeps me stuck in this particular pattern of thought. All memory involves bringing forth some kind of feelings out of a picture. And I have to form that in the moment all the time. I have to sort of equate it with something in my inner life in order that I can have a balance. If I find that I have a picture stuck in me, psychologists call that a fixed idea. And it's the basis of all pathology in the soul, is a fixed idea. It's a belief that something is so that I can't change. That means my will is not capable of changing the picture. So when I remember a triangle and I say triangle, 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 I'm using a very low level of will that I use that when I pull up to a stop sign and I see the picture, my foot automatically goes to the brake pedal. I don't think about it because it's already ingrained in my will to do that. But if I wish to have and so if I get near a piece of chocolate cake and a thought comes up in me, eat the whole thing, then I have to deal with it. Yeah? I have to change that way in which that picture arises in me, which means I have to go back into the feelings that are there that say, eat the whole thing. Some other person can eat the chocolate cake and they eat a little piece and they go away. If I can't do that, it's a great mystery how they can just eat one piece and go away without eating the whole thing. That means I have to have a different kind of will. So yesterday, we had a triangle. I asked you to remember a triangle. That's memory at a very low level of will. That's sort of body memory. There's a picture. I form the feeling, triangle. There it is. Who cares? Triangle. But then I'm saying rotate the triangle and try to see what would happen if you looked at the triangle on the end. And that is not familiar. And that requires a different kind of mobilization of the will to see something you may not have seen before. That's when the will gets spiritualized and moves into places where I begin to imagine things that haven't happened yet. That's called imagination. So if I wish to imagine myself as a better person, that hasn't happened yet. So I need to have some way to change the inner picture that keeps me unhappy, put a picture in there in place of the one that keeps me unhappy, will it in there, and then move it in a way that I would like it to move. That's called as if. It's an exercise that we work a lot with in Sacramento. As if. I try to picture myself as if this thing wasn't the way it is, or I believe it is. It's a very powerful exercise for transformation. But it takes a lot of force. I have to overcome a low level of will in the memory, and I have to move my memory into the future of something I may not have actually seen or understand. If I know projective geometry and the rotation of a triangle ends up with a line in the center, then my task is even greater because that's a memory and I have to search to make that original. I have no will to change it or to say, maybe there's another way. Maybe a triangle in the fourth dimension looks this way, or in the fifth or sixth dimension looks this way. I have to work harder to change my will the more I know. Yeah? So the more my memory is fixed in certain things, the more will I have to bring to the pictures in my inner life to change them and actually replace the pictures that I'm not happy with.